Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, it's my pleasure to have as my guest Stephen Greenblatt. His new book is The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve. His last book won both a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award. That book was The Swerve. His other books include Will in the World. He wrote a book on Hamlet. I would say that his books get more and more emphatically, elaborately readable. And you say at the beginning of the book that we remember the story of Adam and Eve because it's better than other stories, that it's memorable because it's memorable. Mm-hmm. And yet there are millions of people who feel that we remember it because it's truthful. They've made their deductions about the beginnings of time from the story of Adam and Eve and the story of creation.
Well, it's true, Michael, that some 40% of our fellow U.S. Citizens, if one can believe the polls, profess to believe in the literal truth of this origin story. And presumably the world over, there are many more Christians and a significant number of Muslims and Jews as well who, for whom this story says how we got to be the way we are, who we are and how we got here. The story, we don't know when it was first created, but when it was first written down, probably in a rudimentary way, about 1,000 before the Common Era, and then maybe in the 6th century before the Common Era in the form that we know it from Genesis, it wasn't at all clear that you were meant to believe that the story was real. Naked man and woman, talking snake, magical trees in a garden. That was a big move, a move that didn't happen at all easily, to get the story not simply to dig in the way that wonderful stories do, but to get the puppets to have their strings cut and to have them dance as living beings.
Well, you suggest even that the Bible probably didn't begin with the story of Adam and Eve, but the story of God addressing Abraham, one of the forefathers, and that Adam and Eve begins the Bible because it's a better story.
Well, the Jews, like the Muslims, have for themselves the deep commitment to the story of Abraham. Abraham and Isaac for the Jews, Abraham and Ishmael for the Muslims. That's the, how should we say, the identity story. This is who we are as Jews. This is who we are as Muslims. The interesting thing is that the Hebrews decided to put not the Abraham story at the beginning of their sacred book, but to put the Adam and Eve story.
Yes, and we don't know what story was told first, in what order it was told. We are just like any readers, like any aesthetes. We feel instinctively the rightness of Adam and Eve and that garden and that serpent as being the beginning of a sacred text, yes? Or is there evidence?
There isn't evidence. There's a widespread scholarly belief that chapters 2 and 3, the story of the naked man and woman, was earlier than what is written in chapter 1, which is the creation of the human, Ha'adama, in God's image and likeness. Male and female created he them, it says in chapter 1. Most scholars think that that was a later version than the what seems to be more archaic story. But that archaic story is the one, as you say, that you hear and you never forget. You never forget it. That's the fascinating thing.
But I think it's time for everyone to know that before the story of Adam and Eve, there's a bromance origin story. It's known as the Epic of Gilgamesh. It's a Sumerian story, and in it, Gilgamesh and Enkidu are male lovers. It is the male story of which Adam and Eve is the male-female story.
It's not only the male story, as you say, and an incredibly beautiful one.
Very beautiful.
But it is also the oldest surviving story of our species. Strangely enough, the reason it made it is because it was written in clay. And when the palaces and libraries and so forth were burned down, as always happens to civilizations when they eventually fall to another one, everything gets destroyed, except they turned the palaces and libraries inadvertently into kilns, and they fired the clay tablets. And so reaching back huge centuries and centuries, at least 1,000 years and more before the earliest possible traces of the Hebrew Bible or of any other surviving story, we have this remarkable, incredibly beautiful story about Gilgamesh, the hero, and his beloved friend, whom he's dreamt about as the friend has dreamt about him. And then, as in a romance, they meet. Actually, they have an enormous fight with each other, physical fight, and they shake the walls of Uruk, the city, and then they embrace, and for the rest of their lives, they love each other until the death, till death does them part, namely till Enkidu dies. One of the poignant and beautiful parts of Gilgamesh is that it seems to think that you don't have to actually draw a sharp line and make a choice. Gilgamesh and Enkidu have this profound love relationship, but it's also the case in the remarkable epic that Enkidu becomes fully human through the love of the temple prostitute Shamash. And Gilgamesh, when he's mourning his beloved friend, gets the crucial advice that he needs to hear about accepting mortality from a tavern keeper, a woman named Siduri, who's very wise. That is to say, it doesn't imagine that this is a world divided into two distinct species, as it were, men who love only men, women, and men together as the alternative, but a much more fluid account of what human sexuality, human desire is about.
What's amazing, as you point out, my guest is Stephen Greenblatt, is that Gilgamesh and Enkidu own a psychological reality. They are people and partners in a way that Adam and Eve are participants in a story. Mm. We don't know very much about their characters. That's why Mark Twain is so amusing when he gives them characters.
Yes, the restraint, if that's the right way to put it, of the Adam and Eve narrative is extraordinary. We have something like 50 verses, and that's it. It's not Proust or War and Peace. We get remarkably few details about them, but every detail that we get has been poured over now for centuries by some of the most brilliant and some of the most stupid people in the history of the world. That is to say, everyone.
Everyone
has thought about it.
Everyone has thought about it. And that history of who has thought about it, there is the City of God, St. Augustine. Following St. Augustine, there's Dürer, the artist. Following Dürer, there's John Milton. This is a story that will be told as long as there is literature and art.
Gilgamesh is a very ancient story, but it was only recovered in the 19th century. It went underground, literally underground, from the fall of the Babylonian world until the colonial powers dug up and those cuneiform tablets and deciphered them in the 19th century. It has no history of the kind that you're just alluding to, where tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people mused over the meaning of these enigmatic verses, thought about who these people were, and tried to unpack the story. What does it mean? Male and female, created he them. Did that mean that the original creature, this is in chapter one, was hermaphrodite, or were there already two sexes? What does it mean that the male, that Adam, is alone in the garden, and then God says it's not good for the man to be alone? Couldn't God have thought of that from the beginning? Is it a second thought that he's had? How could God have second thoughts? And then when the Bible says, after God says that, he introduces all of the animals to Adam. One thing the early rabbis thought was maybe that meant that Adam tried all the other animals as companions, including having sex with the other animals, and found that it wasn't an adequate experience for him. And then God did the surgical operation to create the female for him.
Now, to me, what's exciting here is that although I had read some Mesopotamian, some Babylonian, some Sumerian literature or fragments of literature, I hadn't put them in the context along with all of the other origin stories. And you do.
The Jews, the Hebrews, I should say, they weren't really Jews at that point. The Hebrews were in exile for almost a century in Babylon after the fall of their kingdom. And they heard these stories again and again. And they, at least the ones who went back from Babylon after the Persian victory, after they were allowed to go back to their ruined kingdom with their destroyed temple, and they put their world together again, they didn't want that story. They wanted a different story. They wanted not the story of Gilgamesh and Kiddu. They wanted the story of the man and the woman.
As you point out, there's nothing called original sin in Genesis.
No. No original sin, but a prohibition and the violation of the prohibition. So what is that about? And that question has, it's fair to say, stuck in the throat of all three monotheisms for the last several millennia. That is to say, there's a God who says you can eat anything you want. They're vegetarians. You can eat any fruit that you want, just not from this tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But if you don't know the difference between good and evil, how would you know how to observe a prohibition? And that's not a perverse modern question. That's an ancient question about the story. So the earliest surviving trace of the story dug up from the sands in 1946, dug up from the sands in Egypt, says that Eve is the hero of the story. Because to choose knowledge, the knowledge of good and evil, must be a heroic act. It must be against an unlawful prohibition. So now that was buried under the sand for several thousand years because it was an interpretation that lost. But the point is that the questions are from the origin of the story itself.
The great story, the story told because it's unforgettable, not the story told because it has the best sense of sin, but the story told because it has a talking snake and talking animals and animals being named and flaming angels, yeah, leading the father and mother of civilization out of the garden into, you know, nightmares. This is the greatest story ever told.
I think it is. I think that the people who wrote in the Psalms their fantasies of revenge, of flinging the infants onto the paving stones, had a better idea than infanticide. The idea that they eventually had was to change the story, to transform our understanding of human origins, and they came up with what I think is the story that seizes you and that becomes unforgettable. And strangely enough, unforgettable not only because of its, in its tiny compass, because of its remarkable narrative vitality, but because of the problems that are impossible to solve. You mustn't eat of the fruit lest you die, says the god to the first human. How would they have known what death is? How could they possibly have known it? They lived in a world without death. And again, that problem has haunted interpretations of the story for a very long time. But it's we think lazily that what we want in our myths is something transparent and simple. But what we want in our great myths is the opposite, the things that we can't so easily swallow and at the same time we can't spit out.
Beautifully said. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Stephen Greenblatt about his book, The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Stephen Greenblatt about his latest book, The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve, a deep exploration of the couple that figures so prominently in humanity's origin story. It's published by Norton. We've got bits and pieces here and there. You're putting it together in orders and juxtapositions that we haven't begun to understand. And because we haven't, we're beginning to understand the world of pronouns that becomes significant here, the world of gender that has never been read about before, in which Eve is the queen of the revelation of good and evil. It's really a very witty book because we haven't really put this all together before.
What I've had huge pleasure finding in the course of the years of work on this book was that there are people, I confess I had never heard of, who had thought deeply and passionately about the story. Arcangela Tarabotti, to take a single example, 17th century nun, forced to take vows in the nunnery against her will by her father because he didn't think she was going to be a good figure on the marriage market because she was lame. She was unhappy in the nunnery, and she was increasingly enraged by the ways in which people cited Eve as the reason for the subordination of women. And so she wrote a remarkable book on patriarchal tyranny, she called it, that goes back to Eve and says, look, Adam was made of dirt. Eve was made of a much superior material, a bone. And was great. was the triumphant creation, far from the inferior creation.
The Confessions of St. Augustine, in a sense, begin as the young man recognizes that his father is looking down and seeing that together as they stand in the bathhouse cleaning themselves, that the young Saint Augustine has an erection. And the father thinks, oh, I'm going to have grandchildren someday.
He's thrilled, Patricius. He sees what the text calls his son's unquiet adolescence, inquieta adolescentia, and he rushes home to share the news with his pious Christian wife, Monica, after whom we get Santa Monica. She was sainted eventually. and she's horrified. She's horrified by this news because she sees nothing but, how shall we say, 100 miles of bad road lying ahead for her beloved little boy, teenage boy at this point. It's the beginning of a long struggle, in effect, over Augustine's soul.
A long struggle about the subject of chastity. About the subject of chastity and whether there is any such thing as a healthful sexuality.
Yes. And Augustine was someone with a very strong, as far as we can, or by his own account, a strong sexual urge. He went to the University of Carthage and had he says, a wild time of it. And only after however long the wild time lasted and whatever it really meant, homosexual, heterosexual, whatever happened, he settled down with a mistress with whom he lived for 13 years and with whom he was quite happy, with whom he had a child, but always with the mother's anxiety and with finally his own anxiety about exactly as you say, whether there is a way of having a normal sexual life that will be compatible with salvation.
You have a mistress, but tell me, when are you going to get married?
That's what his mother said.
Yeah.
And finally, she arranged a marriage for him. He was on a very great career path, an ascendant career path. He was in Milan at this point. And she found a underage but extremely wealthy Catholic heiress. So he had to wait until she reached marriageable age. So at her insistence, the mother's insistence, he very sadly sent away his mistress, whom he had loved, and he felt it was like a rib being torn from his side, he writes. But then, in the interval, while he's waiting for this heiress to come of age, he has his great conversion. And that conversion was a conversion that led him to take monastic vows, to accept the vows of chastity, but also centered on his rethinking of his relationship to sexuality, which meant rethinking his relationship to the story of Adam and Eve. And we come back to that story, which he thought about his whole life.
Not just him, not just St. Augustine. John Milton, already one of the greatest poets known to his generation, returns the way Augustine did. John Milton, who's written Il Penseroso, who's written Comus, who's written some of the great poetry of his time, comes to write the poem that most people agree is the single greatest poem ever written in English.
For me, that is absolutely the greatest poem in our language.
And that is Paradise Lost.
And he thought he had it in him. He thought he had it in him when he was an adolescent, but he hadn't done it. He had written beautiful poems, as you say, but the great poem that he thought he had in him seemed never to be coming. And his life was in ruins. The revolution to which he had devoted his energies and for which, in his view, he had lost his vision, he had become completely blind at that point, had failed. His daughters hated him. He had an extremely difficult, troubled marital relation. He had lost his money. He was afraid of being assassinated. You name it. Everything was miserable for him. And then, really, miraculously, he begins in this state of total abjection to be visited in his sleep by a muse, Urania, who was filling him with poetry. And in the morning, he awakens and organizes his thoughts, and he says to his daughters or to his amanuensis, "Milk me." And they write down the poetry that's come to him in the night. And after months and months of this labor, he has a 10,000-line poem about Adam and Eve that is an absolutely astonishing achievement and remains unrivaled in our language. But the amazing thing about the epic that Milton wrote is that it centers, as no epic had done before, on the intimate relationship of two people who were living with one another. And to me, at least, the most astonishing part of this wonderful poem has to do with Milton trying to think not only about what happens to Adam and Eve when they get expelled, but what happens when they're actually living a life together in paradise? And it turns out that it's not so easy, even in paradise. If you've lived with anyone that you've loved, you actually understand what Milton understands about this, that you have to negotiate lots of things, including, centrally for Milton, do you ever let the person out of your sight? And that, of course, is the key moment in this story for Milton, the moment at which Eve says that she wants to go off for a few hours by herself. And Adam doesn't want her to, but because Milton believed in human freedom, human agency, and the importance of choice, Adam has to let Eve go off. And thereby lies disaster. But it's a disaster that can't be avoided, because no matter how much you love someone, you cannot hold them next to you and never let them go.
These stories, Adam and Eve, well, this kidnapping of Helen, every one of these stories is an unforgettable story that is interpretable in the most moving ways to our sense of what our culture is and remains, more than that, to what poetry is and why it remains.
I agree. This is our birthright as a species, and we need to take it in and love it.
And I thought that this book by Stephen Greenblatt is the very best of his books. I was thrilled by it. This book, I think, was the best work of nonfiction and interpretation that I've read in several years. I found it to be extraordinarily well written, beautiful, powerful, strange, a word that Greenblatt uses again and again, weird.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you.
It was a great pleasure. I'm Michael Silverblatt. I've been talking with Stephen Greenblatt, the author of The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve, published by W.W. Norton & Company. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Alan Howard is our associate producer today. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel, my outgoing assistant, and Sean Sullivan, my incoming assistant. I'm Michael Silverblatt. What a pleasure to have such a moving and important book to talk about. Well, won't you all join me again next time on Bookworm?
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Kazuo Ishiguro is our guest.